Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Kedushim, which is the second part of where we started last Shabbat, and often they're taken together. Acharimot, which covers Leviticus chapters 17 and 18. And today, Kedushim, which covers chapters 19 and 20 of Leviticus. And we picked up the companion passages in Ezekiel 20 and 22, and also passage from Matthew chapter 5 in all of Matthew chapter 18 today. And you can see the various studies that we've done on this particular section in hallel.info/p30. Now, as we were talking last week, that this is a group of instructions that in these two sections of Acharimot and Kedushim, which are talking about elevating your approach to worshiping God, that it's going to be something that is other and different from the nations, and that also it is about respect. So elevating your relationship with God above what is common around you and what the other nations do, and at the same point, respecting your relationship with God and your position before God, and also respecting boundaries between yourself and other people. So those relationships between ourselves, us and God, and between ourselves and also other people around us. So some of what we saw in this particular passage is a key verse, where we get the second greatest commandment there in Leviticus 19:18. You will love your neighbor as yourself. But we also see, as we saw in Leviticus 18, a lot of really uncomfortable things that we discussed about behaviors that happen in ancient society. And as we looked at last week, a lot of those behaviors in ancient society are still with us today. Even if we might say, oh, they are not something that is with us today because they involve an idol or Molech or something like that, when we look at the core aspects of what was going on in those particular behaviors, we see, yeah, you do indeed have that sort of spirit of Molech, even if you are not calling it Molech, because this idea of seeking your own betterment or fertility or prosperity through offering your children up for getting something for yourself, that is what the worship of Molech was like, and also of the fertility cults of long ago. And it is very much what you see going on here today. We talked a little bit about it last week, you know, about the people being happy that they are, you know, dual income, no kids, or having basically their own income, no spouse. And that being seen as something as a benefit for themselves because they don't have to sacrifice something for the next generation. So what we see is we think ourselves as to being so far removed from talk of Molech and mediums and spiritists, etc. And we see not a lot has really changed in 3,500 years between the time period that's being talked about here in Leviticus 17 through 20 and what we're talking about here today. And not a lot changed, even in 1,500 years, when you got between the time that Moses was writing here and the time of Yeshua in the first century. And then not a lot changed in the 2,000 years after that. So we see that we may think that we're so far removed, but we're really not. We're really not. We still have the same kind of problems and struggles. In fact, you know, you might think that someone could come up with a short list of these basic struggles that we have. Indeed, they might even put them on tablets of stone and have them brought down from the mountain of God, maybe. Yeah, and that's what we have. We have what we call the Ten Commandments or the Ten Statements, these testimonies of who the Lord is. And we see that this really is a testimony that worked 3,500 years ago, it worked 2,000 years ago, and it works today. Because why? Human nature is toward the tree of knowledge of good and bad. Human nature, since the Garden of Eden, is not toward the tree of life. But praise be to heaven, praise be to the Creator, that even though our natural propensity since the Garden of Eden is really toward the tree of knowledge of good and bad, basically groping around in the dark, as the Apostle Paul puts it, trying to discover what truth is. Really, that's what the issue has been since the Garden of Eden, and groping about in the darkness to try to find out what the real way to life is about. Is it seeking the beneficence, the goodwill of some fertility deity, whether it be one of crops or of children or of some part of a cult that might bring you some sort of benefits, whether in commerce? Because if you look in the ancient world and you look in the Roman world and you look in the Greek world, they had a lot of the same kind of so-called deities, ones from commerce, of shipping, of even your food and as you grow it. You know, in Eastern cultures, they had all kinds of little deities. They had deities that would supervise to make sure that your kimchi would brew inside of the pots. So they had all kinds of little deities that were over all kinds of life, and you would try to make them all happy, to make sure that you would have bounty, to make sure that your kimchi would turn out good. So we see that really not a lot has changed over time. But when we look at this particular passage, we'll zero in on a really particular aspect of it, because we see that the comparison, we had talked about the Ten Commandments, and there's a lot of parallels between Leviticus 19 and Exodus 20. We'll just go through some of those as our launching off point here. For example, Leviticus 19:2, "You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." Well, that's parallels a lot with Exodus 20, verses 2 through 3. "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Mitzrayim, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me." Well, then how about Leviticus 19:4? "Do not turn to idols or make for yourselves molten gods. I am the Lord your God." That parallels there Leviticus 20, verse 4. And going on to the second commandment, "You shall not make for yourself an idol or a likeness of what is in heaven above or in the earth beneath or in the water under the earth." And Leviticus 19:12 says, "You shall not swear falsely by my name so as to profane the name of your God. I am the Lord." Well, there's a parallel with that in Exodus 20, verse 7. Going on, third commandment, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain." And Leviticus 19:3. "You shall keep my Sabbaths." You shall keep my Shabbats. Well, that's the fourth commandment. Exodus 20, verse 8 starts out with, "Remember the Sabbath day." Remember the Shabbat day to keep it holy. And as we go on, Leviticus 19:3, "Every one of you shall reverence," you know, yerah, or fear, "your his mother and his father." And in Exodus 20, verse 12, which is you call the fifth commandment, "Honor," or kavod, "your father and your mother." that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. Going on back to Leviticus 19:16. You are not to act against the life of your neighbor. Interestingly, because this is where we're kind of zeroing in on today. Well, what do we have on the sixth commandment? Exodus 20, verse 13. You shall not murder. So, interestingly, you are not to act against the life of your neighbor. That's going to become important as we kind of go forward and look toward the second greatest commandment. You are not to act against the life of your neighbor, compared with the sixth commandment, you shall not murder. Leviticus 19:20. Now, if a man lies carnally with a woman who is a slave acquired for another man, but who has in no way been redeemed or given her freedom, there shall be punishment. They shall not, however, put to death because she was not free. And then you see in Exodus chapter 20, verse 14, you shall not commit adultery. So you're seeing in this particular relationship that's being talked about in Leviticus 19, you know, we say a slave being acquired, well, that's not something that we have going on today because that's a part of an ancient economy in which there was no credit cards, there was no payday loans, there was no lines of credit, ways that you could rack up debt and pay things off. Sadly, and like we saw in the parable in Matthew chapter 18, the way in the ancient world that people would sell their debts is sadly they would sell themselves, or they would sell their children. And they would sell their children to be brides often, but also servants in somebody else's household for periods of time. And that you would work off your debt. So, but at the end of that, remember we go through the Shemitah or the sabbatical year cycle, those 7-year cycles. And at the end of that, what happens to the debt? Gone. It's not 30-year mortgage. It's not 50-year mortgage, 100-year mortgage. No, it's basically a 7-year or less. Because remember about the prorated aspect of it as to when you go in to your time of service. So one of the things that's talked about is that for the person who is getting this kind of servant, they are basically buying the debt of the person. And that's a lot of what banks do today. Banks buy debt. They buy your debt and then allow you then to have money to then do something else with it. If you're a business, you get to do things with your business, pay your employees, get equipment with a building, get a mortgage for actual land or such. And if you're a personal loan, then you can get a house or a car or something else like that. But banks, in a sense, are buying your debt. They serve in that purpose of what you're talking about in the ancient world of how they would buy people's debts. At a very high interest rate, yes. So moving on here in Leviticus 19:11 and verse 13, you shall not steal, nor deal falsely, nor lie to one another. You shall not oppress your neighbor, nor rob him. And very interestingly, you see over there on the seventh commandment in Exodus 20, verses 15 through 17, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his male servant or his female servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to his neighbor. So thus you've got 7, 8, 9, 10. They are all encompassed into this particular aspect of stealing, dealing falsely, lying to one another, oppressing your neighbor, robbing him, these various aspects. So what you see in the ways that you deal with other people, these are a part, because remember that The Ten Commandments, these tablets, they're most often called what? Tablets of the testimony, the tablets of the witness. So you are basically having a witness of who God is like. And thus, when you keep seeing these statements, I am the Lord, what, do we go to a medium? Do we go to a spiritist to figure out who the Lord is? No. We look at the tablets, what's written on the tablets, and then explain further out. That is the testimony. When it says, I am the Lord, how do we know who the Lord is? The Lord has testified. The Lord has witnessed to who the Lord is. And a part of that testimony is because the Lord is like this, so then you should also be like that. So it kind of speaks to that idea that some people have of, okay, well, God, that's great. You can stay over there in your box over there, and I'll go visit you once a week and then go home back to the, quote, real world and get on with life. No, this is saying, this is how the creator of heaven and earth is. So then you be holy, be separate from all of that stuff, just as the Lord is separate from all of that stuff. Not, you know, you go, you know, take a belly flop in the pig mire and roll around and wallow in it and then crawl yourself out and kind of wash yourself off once a week. But then the rest of your life, you just do cannonballs right into the mud pit. No, it is that you are to be living separately from that. Now, it's you have those ideas of being dragged away and enticed. Sometimes you slip. Sometimes you're tricked into jumping in. And sometimes, yeah, you even go in. But the question is that do you want to live in the mud pit or not? Do you want to live outside the mud pit? So it's not a question of do we occasionally fall in, jump in, but realize, I don't like it here. Kind of like that parable of the prodigal son, you might remember, when he finally finds himself there in the pig pen, wondering, wow, I'm tending the pigs, and they're eating better than I am. Wouldn't I like to even have just some of the slop that I'm feeding them? But no, I don't even get that much. But how did I end up here in this? I left home. And this, yes, ask for the inheritance. Basically, give me what is mine, as I'm going to take it and then go off and live the way I want to live. And then ending up in the pig pen, wondering, wow, even the most basic people back at the Father's house live better than this. So, thus we can see that some of these instructions, not so far removed from our world here today, how we live, what's going on around us. So we get to the great lesson that we have of Leviticus 19:18. Love your neighbor as yourself. So you've seen here the context of it, that there's a lot here in Leviticus 19 that is recapitulated or bringing back up again the things that you have seen in the Ten Commandments. So, reliving again the things that are in the Ten Commandments. And when we get to the book of Devarim or the book of Deuteronomy, we'll see that a whole big section of the book of Devarim is really a recapitulation, a rehashing of the Ten Commandments. And not only just bringing them up again, which it does in chapter 5, but then from chapter 6 onward through much of the book is explaining and seeing how this is all lived out in the world in all kinds of different situations, some of which we may think are quite distant from who we are today and how we live, but the more we look at them, we realize, not so different. Just as we've seen in Leviticus 18 and 20, some of those icky situations and scenarios that are talked about in there, we think are so far different from how people live today. But we look, what are some of the major issues people are talking about today? They're pretty much listed right there in Leviticus 18 and 20. So have we evolved? More like devolved is probably the better way to put that. So back on to love your neighbor as yourself, Leviticus 19, 18. So the fuller context of it, we quote, love your neighbor as yourself, the golden rule. But the fuller context of it is verses 17 and 18 together. You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but you shall not incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. There it is again. I am the Lord. So that should be taking you back to the tablets of the testimony. I am the Lord, where you learn who the Lord is, because he testifies. Don't have to go to a guru to figure out who the Lord is. The Lord tells you who he is. So, what would the Lord do? You have a bracelet on? Well, he tells you what he would do. And you've got a comment or a question over there. So.
Okay, so the boundaries of the stranger, say our Mexican border, the boundaries. Okay, but the boundaries are also covered by the Lord, with who says, "Don't move your landmark from your neighbor." From your
talking boundary. About moving your neighbor's boundary stones,
right?
Correct.
But then, how do we deal with people just coming in without an invitation, or maybe they get an invitation, but we don't want them on our property in Texas or where the boundaries of. So where do the two of those intersect with the command?
Well, one of the first things is to basically start with the person and then move outward. A lot of us want to leap into national and international discussions, but you start first with the people. Because when you start talking about where things go, they start first with the people. So when you talk about moving your boundary stones, boundaries are around first personal property of that. So that's even come down into modern parlance today. You're pushing the boundaries. You're pushing my boundaries, meaning interpersonal relationships. Someone is trying to take your boundaries. They are picking your boundaries up and then moving them in toward you. And then by extension, what are they doing? They are seizing your property because they are picking that up and moving it. Now, this is both, you could say, on a literal sense, where someone just decides to go in and take parts of your property. But most often, before that happens, before they start lifting fence posts or lifting boundary stones or lifting survey markers, what do they do first? They move the spiritual boundaries first, and they start pushing those in. They start pushing the boundaries in their relationships with you, which is a key aspect of what the golden rule is really all about. It's about how do you deal with people who are pushing boundaries in. Now, with that, you have to figure out, is someone pushing a boundary, and is it a perception of something else that you are thinking someone is pushing your boundary in, when indeed what's probably happened and may have happened is that you have pushed your boundary into them. So that is why we pulled in Matthew chapter 18 into this, because it plays in to this particular conversation of it. So that's when we look at the moving the boundary stones. First, we have to look in at what happens on the personal level. because that determines what happens then on a larger level. Because when you talk about national boundaries, those are really they're extensions of personal boundaries outward. Because what is a nation? Bunch of people. Okay, so you're basically having a collection of boundaries around a bunch of people. And one of the things that you often have with a nation is what? Language. Okay, so you define it maybe by language. Some nations have multiple languages within them. Rules and regulations of how that country works, laws and such like that. So when you start having either a language or groups of languages and then laws that are in common, now you've started to say, this particular area is different from this other particular area. So thus, you're saying, well, how do we know where if we're in one area versus the other? Now, you could take it the sense, well, we don't care. We don't care if there's any difference between this particular group and the one right next to it, or even some farther off in a way. Well, in that case, you could say boundaries don't matter. We don't care about our boundaries. That's one way to take it. Another one is you shouldn't care about your boundaries. And some people will try to assert that you should not care about your boundaries. Now, again, it's one of these things that we have to look within around ourselves first before we then start extrapolating outward. Because we see in Israel's history what happens to the national boundaries when the personal boundaries break down. Babylon comes in. Aram comes in. The Assyrians come in. They push the boundaries. Edom comes in. Philistia comes in. If you don't care about your personal boundaries anymore, your collection of personal boundaries is less important over time. Or you see another thing happen, is that then people will see people coming in and pushing the boundaries and go, well, they need to stop. Well, you also have to ask, do I even care about my personal boundaries anymore? And that, indeed, a lesson for us here today is what Israel went through in that period that we see that led up to the exiles. They stopped really caring about being a different people. They stopped caring about, I am the Lord, be holy as I am holy, and that statement. They stopped caring about that. So, be holy, be different from the Baals, be different from the Asherot, just kind of bring them in, mix them around, make the nice little spiritual smoothie, kind of drink it down. It's nice and smooth, tastes good, nice and cool on a hot day, soothing. They blend it in instead of standing out. So thus, when you talk about boundaries, they're like, why do we need boundaries anymore? No, that's when the 10 tribes went away. They didn't really care about boundaries anymore, because when you see the descriptions in the word about what was happening up in the kingdom headquartered in Samaria, they stopped really caring. They were Israel in name only. They were called Israel, but did they really have the call that Abraham had? Did they carry up that legacy? No, they didn't think that it was worth retaining. They didn't think it was worth retaining the Lord in their heart. So, he gave them up to. Boy, doesn't that sound familiar? It's something that the Apostle Paul talks about there in Romans chapter 1. They didn't think that it was good to keep the Lord in their heart. So, what did they do? The Lord gave them up to what they thought they should have in their heart. So thus, when you see Do not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. So this is one of those things where you would say, okay, well, don't hate them. But the interesting thing, and you'll see a number of ancient commentators will say this, it is right to hate your countrymen, just not in your heart. Well, you're like, that's odd. Wait a minute. You should not hate anybody. But what is the point? What is the point of what they're getting at? Because it goes on, you should not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart, but you shall surely reprove your neighbor and shall not incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance nor bear a grudge against the sons of your people. So this kind of hate starts sounding like what? Hating the sin, not the sinner. Good, there we go. So thus you're starting to see the golden rule in action. So hating the sin, but not the sinner. So in this... Oh, I'm sorry. Tammy's got a comment or a question over here.
Yeah, the difficulty is that there are many people who literally identify themselves with their sin.
Yes.
Then they don't see the difference. So when you, quote, reprove them for something that they're doing wrong, if they identify themselves in that activity or in that thing, they're not going to see the distinction of that rebuke. They're going to say, oh, you hate me because you don't like what I'm doing because I identify with what I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. And that, oh, yes, Eske, go right ahead. It's a really good point we're going to be getting to here shortly.
I guess it's, to me too, it's also related to, for like, if you love your neighbor as yourself, you're going to try to save them. I believe it says it.
Mm.
And in this chapter even, you know, where don't stand by idly when your neighbor's life is at stake.
Uh-huh.
So that's part of
do
it.
Do not is act to against rebuke the life of
your
neighbor.
And could you do it out of love? You know, you don't do it out of hate. You're doing it out of a correcting state and because you love the person. And God wants us to not be afraid to do it. Because yes. If you're afraid of doing it, that's also a sin in itself because you're not doing anything. You're not... You know, you're not being brave. You're just kind of being about yourself, ultimately.
Yeah. So, thus, you've got to really check your reactions to things about to reprove. Okay, we're going to get to more of that here in a moment. So, reprove, because you shall not incur sin, which means that question that comes back from Genesis, am I my brother's keeper? What is the answer? Yes. You shall not take vengeance. So whatever it is you're going to do, it's not going to involve vengeance. Whatever you're going to do, it's not going to be a grudge. And what is a grudge? And the Hebrew word for that is to protect and guard. And it's put into other modern parlance of, I'll take it to my grave. Now that's a grudge. Yes, I hide it in my heart. That's another kind of idiom that comes with that. So thus, between the spectrum of hating your neighbor, so to speak, and loving your neighbor as yourself, you've got these things and conditions in between those, the spectrum. Yes, Larry, go ahead.
There's another place, I think it's in one of Solomon's writings, where it said that no man ever denied himself food and comfort. So loving another as yourself means making sure that they have the things that they need to survive, not necessarily going full boat into, you know, being in love with them or something to that effect.
Deborah, go ahead, please.
Also, being a neighbor is seeing a need and fulfilling it before that person asks, being very attentive to the needs of others. And everybody's your neighbor, you know, always caring, concerned with the true love of to help them, you know, before they even ask you. That neighbor is part of it ingrained in our culture as a people of God.
Yeah.
Because we are his hands and feet. And, you know, it sometimes it's not comfortable. Sometimes it's more than you can bear, but you do it anyway because, and it doesn't necessarily come back from them. So that's neighbor thing is it's, you're doing it to the glory of God.
Mm, yes. Yes. And the master said, who's my neighbor? And then went into the parable of the Good Samaritan. Yes. Yes. Parable of the Good Samaritan. You definitely went out of your way. So it was more than just stopping and inconvenience yourself in a short period of time. The parable of that Good Samaritan went way beyond just stopping to actually take care of the situation. So when you're seeing here about this, proclaiming that heaven declares to be holy, to be holier than thou, it is not that whatsoever. Not a proclamation to be holier than thou, but rather it's something about pointing to what the real issues are within a person. So is it about their self-worth about the person? Is it about extending dominion where you're trying to control the other person? Or is it genuine concern? And one of the things that you can see about self-worth and you're reproving your neighbor to see what it is your intentions are. What is going on with inside yourself for what you want to address with this? And that's where we're going here further, because we see in the word, there is a whole lot of instructions about you shall surely reprove your neighbor, as we see in Leviticus 19:17. We'll take a look at some of these here. But this idea of ourselves as havens of holiness, that we are to be separate, we have a lot of instruction in the word about what that means to be separate, and then calling other people to be separate in this. So just to have this down so you might have it available, we got this list available that you can look up. We'll be taking a look at some of these here as we go on. Proverbs chapter 9, verses 7 and 8. He who corrects a scoffer gets dishonor for himself, and he who reproves a wicked man gets insults for himself. Do not reprove a scoffer, or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man, and he will love you. So thus, in our attitude, both in what we think people might need a correction on, and then also if we are getting a correction, what sort of attitude are we taking it at? You know, are we, when we are receiving this, you know, are we truly asking, seeking for wisdom? Do I need correction on this? Where have I fallen down on this? Where have my boundary stones intruded upon somebody else, so to speak, upon their territory? Yes, Anne, you got a comment or a question over there?
It's kind of difficult to judge. You see, you have to make a judgment on your neighbor, saying, well, is this guy a scoffer, first off, before I try to reprove her or him about this, what's going on here, or is it wrong for me to make a judgment on, you know, so you see what's going on next door, you can't help it, you know. So you have to have some kind of wisdom in judging, when can I or should I reprove a scoffer? Or should I judge everybody as being wise and say, well, this one must be wiser than me anyway, so I'm going to say something here. So you see the dilemma.
Yes. And see, that's one of the things that in our world today, we are oftentimes so far separated from other people that we really don't know what's going on within other people. So thus, it's one of those things to be careful about how we decide to then intrude ourselves upon somebody else. So if we do know somebody else, then there is the inroad in the relationship to be discussing. And figuring out what is going on between the people and to bring this issue up. Because if you just think of it, take this extension out with talking about boundary stones and fences. If you have a property and you don't know where the boundaries are, what do you do? Call a surveyor to figure out, go back and figure out where are the boundary stones supposed to be, and they'll mark things out. So sometimes, if we don't know each other well or something we don't know, we might need a surveyor of a sort to really help with that. And then now you're starting to see a lot of where the Matthew 18 instructions from the master come in, where you can need that outside idea. You know, you can be coming up with this great argument. Hey, my property actually is 5 feet over there. Well, the surveyor might come in to find out, no, it's not 5 feet closer to your neighbor. It's 5 feet closer to you. Oh, okay. So are you ready for that kind of an answer from someone else to assess the situation from the outside and go, yeah, you may think that you've been harmed, but you may be the one that's doing the harm here in the situation. So with this advice and counsel here from Proverbs is to be open on both directions. The scoffer is the one who cannot really accept correction, even if they're the one who thinks someone else needs correction, that they can't accept correction themselves because they think, well, it's the other person that's in the wrong. Well, maybe not. Maybe not at all. I'm sorry, Larry, did you have a comment there?
Well, I was just thinking again about what the master said when he said, you know, don't judge ye not, lest ye be judged.
Yes.
And then, but later on in that same paragraph, he said, talked about how we do judge others by their works.
By the standard you use.
And then by the, yes. You say that we lost it in our culture because he gave us a list. Here's how we know. It's the Torah. It's the instructions, right? Is the list of things that we'll know. Where the infractions are, if we don't pay attention to them, then we don't know.
Yeah, and that's one of the things when we go through the book of Deuteronomy in that long section from chapter 6 through, I think, 25 or something like that, where it just is in great detail of each of the commandments. And it brings up a lot of these scenarios. A lot of them may seem ancient, but a lot of those have their modern corollaries that we can hook into and see, oh, as a basis for starting the look to see, well, how is it that the situation that I'm dealing with now is very similar to the situation that's talked about in the Word? And that should be the starting place that you go off. Deborah, you got a comment or a question over there?
Comment. I just want to say that most of us, I believe, in this room do want to be corrected, but the delivery, and I don't care who it is,
delivery,
people, you
yes.
always get defensive, your voice gets racy, you're like, oh, and then, you know, you're processing in that moment because some of it's embarrassment or taking accountability or did I say that or did I mean that? There's so many variables. And, you know, and when I was in the JC to get my certificate in human service and advocacy, we sat at a round table and we practiced scenarios. And I think that's lacking in groups sitting in round tables on how to come across, because I think every one of us here love each other. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been spending the last 20 years together. You know what I mean? That's a long time. And sometimes with all the pressures that are going on in the world, things can come across unintentional. And it's very difficult to go to somebody and talk to them because how do you begin? Or how? And that's not really ever really... We say this scripture all the time, every year, but how does that look? How does that operate? Because it usually doesn't turn out that way. If you can confront somebody, things usually go haywire, you know? So I'm saying this is all, it's good. However, if we were practicing it, I think we would have some mock interviews.
Well, you know, something, another kind of an interesting idea of looking at the situation is, you might say it gets kind of cold to look into some legal documents, but when you have a lot of legal documents, you often have what? Recitals. what they call. Recitals are what? They're basically just hashing out various facts, and they might come from one side or the other side, and you're kind of bringing these things out, and each one of you, using the 50-cent word, stipulates to it. We'll just say, okay, all right, we agree with that. That's your position. This is my position. We bring all these things together, and then where do we go from there? But once you got all those things out there on the table, you're like, well, what are we actually arguing about here? What are we arguing about? Is this about this, or is it about, you know, the fact that, you know, you took my chair 30 years ago and didn't give it back? Or is it that? And interestingly enough, I mentioned this in times past, but in talking with some estate attorneys, when they have families arguing over the wills, oftentimes it's not about what it is at issue. You know, you'll have the family and they'll be arguing over a table and just getting into screaming matches and lawsuits over a table that was the parents. But it's not about the table. It's about something that was between the two of them that happened 20, 30 years ago. And sometimes these estate attorneys say, you almost have to have group therapy with the family before you even have the will read, because it's like you've got to deal with some of these interpersonal issues to actually figure out what is actually going on here. And if there's deep hurts that need to be healed, you might need to deal with those before you even get to what the actual issues that you need to actually work on here. Because if you don't, you're never going to even get to those recitals, the things that you need to discuss, the facts of the case, so to speak, because you're still arguing and coming to blows over issues that are not related to what you're actually talking about here. So I'm sorry, does somebody have a comment or a question? Yes, Larry, you have got a comment or a question. Hold on just a moment.
We should be careful that when we quote scripture, we quote the whole scripture.
Yes.
And so many people, like they say, don't judge me. Scripture says, don't judge me. Yeah, but it also says, I can judge you if it's the instruction, say the other thing. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to tell you whether you're saved or not, or what your relationship is with God. I don't know. But I know that this says this over here. And then, as you say, then you have to discuss it and decide whether or not you agree.
Yeah, and as we saw in this particular passage of Kedoshim, and then we also saw in the passages that we read from Matthew, you have to have the equal balances. You got to make sure that you have brought in your commissioner of weights and measures, so to speak, to analyze what it is you're using to measure things. Because if you have a kangaroo court, so to speak, that you're using to evaluate and deal with your interpersonal relationships, how effective is that going to be? If you've got things that are just ramrodded through because the judge or whatever people that are using to determine the situation, they've already come to a conclusion of what it's going to be. Well, have you actually resolved anything? No. You've crammed down your position, but have you actually resolved anything? No. Larilla, go ahead, please.
One of the other things to kind of piggyback onto what Larry said was make sure when you're quoting scripture, you're actually quoting scripture. I actually had a person who argued with me because this was in their brain an actual scripture. God helps those who help themselves, and God help those who get caught helping themselves. And I said, where is that scripture? That's not in the Bible. Yes, it is. And I said, no, it's not. The first part was Shakespeare, and the second part is the punchline to a joke. So be very careful for yourself if you're going to be proclaiming scripture that you know, and at least have the address for it. So when people say, where'd you find that? Well, that was in whatever. So,
yeah, because you don't want them to come up with one, God helps those who help themselves to your stuff. Yes. Another passage that we have here, Proverbs 12:1. Whoever loves discipline loves knowledge, but he who hates reproof is stupid. Yes, or lacks wisdom is another way you could translate that. So one of the ideas that we should have on this is that we use the modern parlance of teachable, that we are teachable, that we can be instructed on some things. So I know I have a terrible problem with that myself, especially in any sort of thing that I take some sort of, you could say, vocational acumen to. Like, for example, with my bass playing, if I got someone who tells me how I should play a line, boy, that chafes. And I can feel it every time, and I hear scriptures like this in my head. Every single time I get an instruction like that, I just have to say, okay, why don't you just try it? Just try it. You may learn something. And guess what? I usually do learn something. I think one of the most instructive things that I ever did as a musician was I had to play for a recording artist their music as it was recorded in the studio. I went into the first audition, and I played it how I thought it should be played. Oh, No, I was like, they spent a lot of money hiring a studio bassist there in Nashville to record it. They wanted it played the way it was on the recording. I was like, well, nah, okay. So I was like, all right, time to go to the woodshed. So I went home, and I learned it note for note and note for note. Even some things, there was a couple lines in there where I said, this is nails on a chalkboard because it's dissonant, and I hate dissonance in music. And it's like, they wanted it that way, so I played it that way. And you know what? It's like, okay. I learned that that's the way that you sometimes in life, you have to learn that way, is that you can take instruction and that you can grow because of it. Because there were some parts in there that I have to admit, that the way the studio musician did it was probably far beyond I would have ever done or even thought to have done it. So when I went there and learned how to play that line, I was like, okay, I actually learned something and I've used those lessons going on. So even in stuff that you think you know well, be ready to be teachable on that. Yes, Alurula, go ahead, please.
So if you take the word discipline and you break it down, to discipline is to disciple. We all want to be disciples, don't we? Therefore, a disciple loves knowledge, loves getting closer. So when I see whoever loves discipline, I read it, whoever loves to be discipled, whoever wants to become closer to God. And then it doesn't feel near as rotten when you get discipled.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good point, because the idea of disciple, because you can also take discipline to mean disrespected. So are you, when you're getting disciplined, are you being discipled or are you being disrespected? Now, we might just think of ourselves more than we ought, and so we would just start lumping a lot of discipline into the disrespect category. And then what? Miss the discipling, miss the instruction, training, tutoring to move on. Another passage here from Proverbs 26, verses 4 and 5. This is always a logical gymnastics when it takes a few reads of this. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you will be like him. Answer a fool as his folly deserves, that he not be wise in his own eyes. Because the funny thing is that in Hebrew, both of those opening lines are identical. It's said exactly the same way on both of those lines. And you're like, wait a minute, how can you come to totally different things with the same premise? Do not answer a fool according to his folly, but answer a fool according to his folly. What do you mean by that? And so you see the first line where it says, or you will be like him. So folly in parlance is that idea of Yabel, or we call it like being like the wind. So you are someone who is blowing with the wind. So in Proverbs, when you see a fool, it is someone that is easily blown by the world and thus blown away from God. So when you see fool show up in Proverbs, that's what it's getting at. Not just someone who's clueless, but someone who is not anchoring themselves to anything, so they can just easily be blown away. So thus, do not answer a fool according to his folly, according to his, to use a terrible word, unanchorability, where they just will not put down an anchor. But so why? Because you don't want to be blown around like they are. Or as the Apostle Yaakov puts it, what? Like a ship tossed back and forth in the ocean. Rather, answer a fool according to his folly, or as his folly deserves, that he not be wise in his own eyes. This is basically saying the exact same thing of what we saw back in Leviticus chapter 19, about reproving a person to do what? Make sure that you show that you're boss and cram it down on them? No. So that you keep him from making a terrible decision and a terrible choice, to help him from going down a bad road. Because one of the things that we look in Ezekiel each week, and we read that passage, that we don't want people to fall into their own demise if you see it coming. Because that's like, if you are a witness to something, and you can have some sort of impact in it, and you don't do anything about it, yeah, the blame is upon you. And to varying degrees, that comes over into our modern world, where to varying degrees, you could be held legally liable if you had a chance to do something and you don't. Sadly, we have with the Good Samaritan laws have sometimes been strengthened and sometimes been loosened and used as a weapon, where people step in to help and then a ton of bricks from the legal system comes down on their head because of it. So thus, what happens the next time? People see the ton of bricks comes down on this guy's head as he's trying to help, and he's like, I'm gonna take a pass. So that's sadly what happens when you see some kind of calamities happen. People's first reaction is to what? Run to help or to click record on their phone? Yeah. So in the passage we were looking at here in Matthew chapter 18, verses 15 through 17, if your brother sins, go and show him his fault in private. And if he listens to you, you have won your brother. But if he does not listen to you, take one or two more with you, so that by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every fact may be confirmed. There's a quote from Deuteronomy 19:15. And if he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the ecclesia, or the congregation. And if he refuses to listen even to the congregation, let him be to you as one of the nations, a Gentile and a tax collector. And that's not meaning that as a Gentile and a tax collector that you treat them with disdain. What that just means is that they are no longer what you could say someone close to the congregation. Someone, you treat them as someone who needs to be called in and, you know, instructed and brought into the congregation. Because, you know, you can't have the Messiah saying in one case, hey, treat them like one of the Gentiles and a tax collector and never talk to them again. And then in other passages say, hey, I didn't come for the well, I came for the what? Sick. When he was asked, why do you eat with what? Sinners and tax collectors, the foreigners. Those others. So thus, one of the things that we've seen here so far is that, you know, we might look at Matthew chapter 18 and say, well, all I need to do is just take somebody with me to confirm that this guy is just totally off his rocker and he needs to be reproved. He needs to be corrected. Rather, what you should be doing is to bring somebody who can tell you that you may be off your kilter and that you are in the wrong. And maybe the person that you're looking to reprove is in the right. And then maybe if the two of you who are going can't convince it, you take to the congregation, because maybe both of you are wrong, that you're trying to say, hey, someone has actually sinned against me. Maybe they haven't. But if they have, and they still won't listen to the counsel of two people there, well, bring it to the congregation. And how that's come down through time is that you take it through to, like, elders. Oh, okay, Pamela, you have your hand up there. Please go ahead.
I was caught when you were saying be teachable. So I'm wondering about situations I've been into. I met a Nazi who had a big swastika tattooed across his whole back. And so I tried discussing with him, like, I don't know a thing about it. And then recently, one of the grandmothers here has a teenage grandson who's transgender. I don't know if he's actually mutilated his body yet, but I'm sure that he's going in that direction if he hasn't already. He wears makeup and wears high-heeled shoes and dresses, you know, yes, wearing pants, but I mean, everything else about him is turning feminine. So she invited another of her friends to walk across the street in the shopping area with her. And first, that friend tried to refuse the offer, but then I don't know how that ended up because I wasn't going to linger around. But I would think that this thing could pass even if he lives another 20 years. But if he's going to mutilate his body, that's, you know, a done deal. So I don't have that kind of rapport with this grandmother that I can come right out in the open, but neither would I ever run into him alone. So that's kind of a deal. You know, if I say something, I might, you know, get spotted or something like that. I might get punched. So I don't know how to handle it. But also, you were talking about be teachable. Well, for the Nazi, I acted like I could learn from, you know, what this guy thinks Nazism is. But with the homosexual fellow, he's so deep into it, and he's still a youth.
Yeah.
Those are my comments. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, like you're talking about with the grandmother. As the grandmother, you're talking about two separate people here. Is the grandmother with both of these people have a connection, a close connection with them?
Not the Nazi with the homosexual, no.
Right. Well, it's depends upon your connection with people, because like we were talking about before, if you don't really have any sort of connection with people to just throw something out there, what do people do? Walls up, shields up, incoming fire, and they hunker down. So if you do throw out the sorts of things to try to help them, they may not see that it is help. So that is a point where you have to, like, for someone that you're just having some sort of a brief encounter, like with the guy with the large emblem on his back, with those sorts of things, you know, you really have very limited opportunity to have any sorts of things, because there's all kinds of things that could be going on in there. A sense of wanting community, because it might be a part of an emblem that is a part of a group or whatever that he's affiliated with. And he feels like this is a part of a camaraderie with it. And so maybe he doesn't buy into all of what that emblem means that's on his back. Maybe he really doesn't know, or maybe he does know, because you have a lot of the folks who may be diehard Satanists. They buy into all of the ideology. So when they've got the emblems of that false god or whatever, they buy into it all the way. But the other ones may have bought into the secular side of it. That is all about power and is a worshiping of power. And that can also be what the emblem was that you're encountering there, is that it is associated with power and that you can have power over either what you perceive as slights of some other group or whatever. The other, that could be. But without knowing what it is, you could just basically say, and one of the responses that is often one of the best things you can do in a case where you have really no connection with it is, hey, there can be a better way. I know a better way. People may not be open to it. They just, well, what are you talking about? I don't want to know. It's just basically, hey, there can be another way. Because one of the things of talking with those people who are just worship power, like folks with that emblem and those that may be involved with Satanism, they like power. They like domination over it. Because of why? Maybe something in their background, maybe not. People are just attracted to power. Whether it's in politics today, whether it's in relationships, whether it's in families, some people just like power. Because of why? All kinds of situations, both inside them and outside them. For some people, they may just feel beaten down by all kinds of circumstances, so they want to exert any sort of power they can. So they just look for the kinds of things that will give them power. Whether they look for somebody who is weaker than them physically or emotionally, and then just what? They dump it on them, whether physically or emotionally. Or they look for organizations that can intimidate other people and then bring it physically or emotionally to other people. But without dealing with those strongholds, you know, you're just basically, and especially with some sort of passing thing, just passing them in the wind. Best thing you can do is just say, hey, there can be a better way than this. Or as someone else says that, you know, works with a lot of people in downtown Santa Rosa who can barely conceive of reality, they'll just say, you don't have to live like this. And it might get through at a moment of lucidity or soberness where it gets through. You don't have to live like this. And maybe they can just finally wake up to it, and the Spirit of God can just finally wake them up to, hey, this kind of life doesn't have to be lived like this. So maybe the Spirit of God can get through them, or maybe it's just going to take time. So with those two situations that you're talking about, with a grandmother that's involved, that can be an influence to say, hey, there can be a better way. Because one of the things that's just come out here in the past few months is, and through some leaked documents from the WPATH organization, which is the one that the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association has depended upon for their gender dysphoria counseling regimens, that's been found to be a total farce. Is there's actual recordings of them saying there's no scientific basis for our treatment methods on this, which is why you're seeing some European governments, like the National Health Service of Britain, has dropped all of their gender transition programs. No hormones, no surgery, nothing. They've just cut that out because they realized that the so-called science underneath it is vacuous, doesn't exist. And the evidence that's starting to pile up on the other end is that, no, it's actually disastrous. So one of those things that's as underlying that kind of a situation that grandmother is dealing with is oftentimes it can be either something happening within the family that's pushed somebody to this, or it can be influence from the society around. So there's all kinds of situations that go into it. But with anything, the starting point is it doesn't have to be like this. You can live a different way. It may get through, it may not get through. But one of the things that you can offer is empathy and sympathy on this, because that is what we've been going through on the greatest commandment, or the second greatest commandment in Leviticus 19:18. When you love your neighbor as yourself, you have to put yourself in, sort of think about it, in the situation of the person that is hearing this. If you were in need of some sort of correction, how would you want someone to speak to you? Would you want someone to speak down to you? Would you want someone to try to manipulate you or this or that? No. You would want somebody who actually has their hearts, you know, connected to yours, and that they hurt if you're hurting.
I had, you know, my grandmother had alternative lifestyle, and in my experience, they're good people, love people, you know, and I always use the analogy where I am a Christian and I need to be celibate. So I, therefore, that goes both ways for that, you know. I think, you know, society is giving them the wrong messages, telling them there's something wrong, giving them medication. And we don't know where it stems from. There's some research, but my thought is just to tell somebody, you know, you can be, deal with whatever your thing is, but you can be celibate too. And so God loves you, you know, because sometimes they have a bad idea that, you know, God doesn't love them, and he does, you know. So, you know, that's a very close and dear to my heart because my grandmother was gay, but, you know, we couldn't talk about it then. And it really ruined our lives because, you know, my dad made fun of her. And so I know that's something that's really sentimental to me. And, you know, and I've had a lot of friends that have alternative lifestyles. And I think the way to get through them is to love them and to be sympathetic and kind. Telling somebody that something's wrong with them, you know, I'm having sex outside of marriage. I am no different. It's an abomination to God too. You know, so I think that, you know, much training needs to be able to reach somebody, you know?
Yeah, indeed. And that's what the whole point of love your neighbor as yourself. It comes into how would you want someone to treat you in this if you were headed off in a different direction. And, you know, we can, in society today, we can say, because the arguments that are made here in society today are really not much different than were done many years ago, or even in the first century, or even going back 3,500 years to where the time of the Moses and the Torah was. The situations and the arguments and such that were made in those times, not a lot different. Wanting to pursue your connections with the divine, wanting to, because one of the things that you see in society today, very similar to what it was in the first century, and even of what we have recorded from the Canaanite world that this Torah was written into, you see that there was a lot of connections between relations between individuals and their relations with the divine, just to put that delicately. And that is why there were professionals that were working in temples to help people to reach their connections with the divine. Because why is it that you see a lot of experiential writings that have come out in the past 50 years or so that have a connection or that link connections between people with connections with the divine? It's not modern. It is as old as the beginning, that there is seen to be a spiritual connection, because there is. People can try to deny where that comes from and think you're trying to tap into some sort of connection with the other world out there. But really, it's just a part of the design between how the Creator made them in the beginning. Genesis 1, 26, 27, in the beginning he made them male and female. And we know how both genders were created, no mystery there, and how the Creator made things between male and female. So there's no need to shrink away from it. We know anatomically that things were made to be great, and there was to be a great connection between male and female. So the question is that, like with the garden, who is building this connection? Is it the one that leads to life, or is it the let's figure it out tree of knowledge of good and bad? The world, for thousands of years, has been selling the let's try to figure it out category of it, and going into all kinds of different realms. So the question, though, comes in, if we do know how it is that male and female are created, what then is the highest and best use? The highest and best use for all of us, our grand and divine calling. To the let's figure it out and connect with who knows what? Or are we connecting with our Creator? So we can say, well, this is an icky topic. We like to shy away from it. Why? Come on. And it's like in the first chapter, Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, he made them male and female. No mystery there. So with that, now what? Do we just go to the land of let's figure it out? Or do we say, this is a part of the Creator who wants to connect with us? So what then are we doing with the gifts that he has given to us? Interpersonal relationships, connections between male and female. What are we doing with all this? Are we doing it for the let's try to figure it out? Or are we doing this for the glory of the one who created everything, one way or the other? Eski, yes, go ahead, please.
Yeah, on that topic, I just did a DNA test, and the only question they ask you is not like, what do you identify as? It says, at birth, what were you assigned at birth? Because your it's in your DNA. It's in your blood, and the blood is your life. So that can't be argued. It's either male or female on that.
Yeah. I mean, there are the incredibly rare cases where they call true intersex, where that is not normal. It's like when you go back to what you call, Larry and I talk about computer programming a lot. You have a computer program. All of us, even if you have a smartphone, you turn it on, it does stuff. You hit the power button, you see a logo. But the logo just doesn't appear out of your phone for no reason. There were programmers in there that wrote a sequence that when you push that button, it's going to bring up the logo and then bring up your phone, and then you're going to be able to make calls, you can make text messages, you can go onto various social media and this and that and the other. It runs on a sequence. That's what programming does on this. So for reproduction, when you get things started, you will have a child. And it may be male or it may be female. And there's certain cases where things go wrong, because if you've ever looked into human reproduction, my goodness, what kind of programming is involved there with the hormones and the various things that are just an incredible cascade that happens from one stage to the other, and this happens. And can you imagine writing that software that's going to make this chain, that's going to hand off to this and this and this and this and this all the way down? Well, in some cases, just like with computer software, things go wrong and your phone crashes or your computer crashes or such. I mean, that is just in a world where things are not perfect now. Yeah, you get hit by a neutrino. Yes, that's the one thing about that you can actually have the neutrinos either from the sun or somewhere else that can come into your computer and actually knock data and change it. So you can have all kinds of things that can happen, and it will move it from the way it was designed to happen. And we see that with kinds of birth defects on it. Does that make anybody less human? No. Whether it's Down syndrome or a number of other sorts of defects that can happen, does that make you anything other? No, not at all. It's just that those things happen. Some people are short, some people are tall, some people have one defect or another, some people have extra fingers, some people have fewer fingers. Things can happen on it. But when you look in the main side of it, when just like when you turn on your phone, you expect something to happen with children. When you start a pregnancy, you can expect something to happen, and it's going to be either male or female. Sometimes it's in between, and you have the things that are different, but that is an anomaly that happens. Yes, Eski, go ahead, please.
So my original thing was back to at what we've been talking about with reproving, because out of love and out of not facing your fears, you know, because it's easy to not reprove something. And if you find, you know, fault or something, or you question it, I believe that us, if we love each other and we respect each other and we want to grow together and be strong. So I've felt, you know, that I had to bring this up, you know, that we're, it's all the pieces were falling in line. So I'm looking at, I want, you know, anyone to correct me if I'm wrong, but with the Star of David as being a logo or an emblem that's not quite fully understood, I know that, you know, it does represent Israel as a country and everything, but in all my research, the origination of the Star of David was actually not used by David at all. It was used by Solomon. It was the Star of Solomon and came from one of his wives who was an Egyptian princess, I believe. She was high up and she was buried in the you know Temple of David as
well.
And
lots of princesses from lots of countries.
Yeah, he had a lot of wives. So what I heard from the star is actually the Star of Remphan, and the 6 points actually represents, it's a hexagon, and the term hex comes from that. Comes from when you put a hex, a curse on someone, it comes from the hexagon star. So
interesting. Well, just in closing, that's a topic in and of itself, but just a couple of things, because I've heard this a lot of times over the years. Just to put it short, there is not a lot of truth to that idea, because in ancient Hebrew, because today you write a Dalet, which is David's name. David in Hebrew is, you know, it's Dalet Vav Dalet. So David is actually, it's either David or as it's in the Septuagint, and you can even, some linguists try to say it's David. It's either David or Dawid. So it's Dalet Vav Dalet. Well, in ancient Hebrew, it's very much like the Greek, the Greek alphabet actually preserves a lot of what ancient Paleo Hebrew looked like. And in Paleo Hebrew, the Dalet is not like a bar with a line down on a little bit off to the right side of it. It is a triangle. It is a triangle. It is like the delta of Greek, the capital delta of Greek, is what the ancient Hebrew Dalet was. That's why in ancient Hebrew, Phoenician, in Greek, the Dalet D sound comes over, it's the same. So what then do you have with David? Two triangles, which are interposed off of each other. So hex is Greek, and it just means six. It's a word in Greek that means six. So hex, it's one of those things that when you say hex, it is other, it is, it's actually a, also from a Anglo-Saxon word, which comes from a different derivation, which is sometimes where you, some people will take a word from one language and then take it to another language and say, well, it's the same spelling, but you know, that's like, there's a common way that this is illustrated. What is a gift? Present? What if you're German? What is a gift? What is it? Poison. So if you're German, don't be asking for gifts. But it's the same word spelled the same exact way. So that's one of those things that you can have words that, that sound the same in different languages, but have completely different derivations on them. And that's that one of the things that, you know, you might just discuss it with some people on that, because I've heard that a lot over the years. And yeah, so just those two things. Ancient Hebrew dalet is a triangle. Two triangles together, interposed, that's where you get it. And hex is not, is in Greek means six, and in and Anglo-Saxon means something else. Yes, go ahead, please.
Yeah, this is on a different note. I wanted to ask you about, there are some offenses in the chapter we just read in the Torah portion today that are capital punishment.
Capital punishment, yes.
And then there is others that say cut off.
Yes.
So is it the same or it's different? Cut off or put to death?
Slightly the same. Slightly the same. Cut off just means you are no longer welcome in the community. So with that, you are... persona non grata mean you're not any sort of person who is going to be accepted into the local community. Now, with that, in ancient worlds, you know, we could, oh, okay, I'm not liked here. I'm just going to move to New York. It didn't work like that in the ancient world. If you were outside of your community, not allowed in, who is going to take you in? It's not like you can just move to Mexico or move to France or something like that. It didn't work like that in the ancient world. If you were cut off from your community, it was like you were dead. And it could soon lead to your actual death on that. So thus being threatened with being, say, hey, you can't come back here. That was... Same thing was also related to in the ancient world about divorce. If you were to divorce a woman in the ancient world, you were almost signing her death sentence on that, which is why there was the provision for taking another woman in to your household. That was mainly only just to keep her alive, basically. But the provision was also in there. It's like, okay, you've got this philanthropic sort of idea. But if you're going to do that, you're not just going to treat her like some sort of second-class citizen. If you're going to do that, she is going to be on equal status with your other wives that are in there. But thus, you also see the provision in there that you see coming into the Gospels is like, okay, there is an allowance in here, but don't do it. And that's, you see, the Messiah says, you know, that in the beginning he made them male and female, so thus man leaves his parents, woman leaves her parents, and they join together, and the two become one. And thus, that is it. You're not, you know, the three become one, the four become one, and the 60 become one, and on it goes. That in the original design, that is where it would be. Between a male and a female, and coming together. But because of societal issues and such, in the ancient world, just if you were to have a woman out on her own, that was just awful. So some families would take the women in. So differences in economies of the time period. It's not like that, nearly like that anymore. So thus, when you say, if you have that kind of a situation, that's where you would have that allowance. But number one, don't do it. Number two, we don't have that situation anymore. So I hope that kind of fits in with that. That's the cutting off from the community is that idea that you just don't, another way to use the larger term for it is excommunication is a similar idea for that, only to be done on extreme circumstances that you were to do that kind of thing.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.